70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. Throughout the year, we celebrate the 70th anniversary of KBS World Radio with the voices of our listeners from all over the world.
저는 미국 동부 버지니아 살고 있는 뉴정희.
I'm Nyu-jung-hee from Eastern Virginia. When I first moved to the United States, I really wanted to listen to radio from back home. I managed to get a shortwave radio and have been tuning in ever since for the past 35 years. Both my husband and I are big fans of KBS World Radio. We listen together when we're both off work on the weekends. My husband really, really likes KBS World Radio. Sometimes if I'm still in bed when the program starts, he would bring the radio right next to my ear to wake me up, urging me to listen with him. My brothers back home are always surprised by how updated I am with news from Korea. My Korean friends here also ask me all the time about what's going on in Korea right now. Congratulations on the 70th anniversary. KBS World Radio, thank you, and I love you.
축하드립니다. 감사합니다. 사랑합니다.
70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. KBS World Radio brings Korea to you wherever you are.
Hello, it is Thursday, the 16th of March, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. President Yoon Suk-yeol described Japan as a partner that shares universal values with South Korea to open the highly anticipated summit with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida in Tokyo. We'll have more in news briefing shortly. The financial world has been rattled over the past week after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. We take a look back at what happened and the jitters being felt here in Korea for our in-depth today. And coming up for Explore Korea, we'll be taking a breather as we find out about Buddhism, meditation, and Seoul Relax Week. Let's begin Korea 24. Let's continue on now, rounding up the rest of the day's headlines. And for that, we have our KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin, joining us in the studio. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-ho.
What you're hearing now are the opening remarks being exchanged between President Yoon Suk-yeol and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida before they began their summit today, held in Tokyo for the first time in 12 years. President Yoon described Japan as a partner, while Prime Minister Kishida said it was an opportunity to open a new chapter in bilateral relations. While the two also agreed on the importance of bilateral cooperation against North Korean threats, at a press conference later, they also confirmed that there will be no contribution by Japan to the fund to compensate Korean victims of wartime forced labor for now. We have joining us on the line now James Sims, a freelance journalist and television and radio commentator in Tokyo, who has covered the Japanese economy and politics for two decades now. Mr. Sims, thank you for your time today.
Oh, yes. Good to be with you.
First, can you tell us about some of the outcomes that have come out from this summit today, perhaps starting with the resumption of the so-called shuttle diplomacy?
Right. I think that was probably one of the biggest sort of takeaways from the meeting between the two nations. I mean, this is the first time that leaders between the two nations have met directly outside of international meetings. And so Prime Minister Kishida described it as he was talking about how the sakura cherry blossoms were starting to bloom in Tokyo, and how this long winter in relations was the long winter was ending, and how relations would improve going forward, and how that he wanted to build upon the 1998 joint resolution between South Korea and Japan on improving relations towards the 21st century. And so I think shuttle diplomacy, I mean, people were talking about maybe Cold War shuttle diplomacy, where people were trying to sort of intermediate between tensions in a certain region. I think maybe when they say shuttle diplomacy, it's more like it's something that's very common, you know, like flights between Seoul and Tokyo. It's so common that it's not taken, you know, it's just seen as something that's normal, not as something that, you know, has to be dealt with and has to be put together over like months and months. It's just something that happens regularly, just like a shuttle flight between Seoul and Tokyo.
Right. Shuttle diplomacy here refers to, regular back and forth visits between the two leaders to each other's countries. While in the West, it means perhaps the negotiations that are conducted between a mediator who travels between the two parties.
For example, in the United States, you have shuttle flights between, say, New York and Washington, or New York and Boston, and they're like on they're like on every 30 minutes or every hour.
Right.
And it's just something that regularly happens, and nobody thinks twice about it happening.
So this suggests Prime Minister Kishida will make a reciprocal visit to South Korea soon, although today he said there is no details on that for now. What about some other outcomes? What about the trade whitelist? Both countries took each other off their respective trade whitelists at the height of tensions in 2019 as part of apparent retaliatory measures. But that is now, they have now taken, they're now back on each other's trade whitelists, I understand.
Right. So, I mean, Japan lifted the regulations or the strengthened regulations regarding certain components and materials that were used in semiconductors. So that has ended. And then South Korea, for its part, said that they would take back the, I guess, complaint that they had lodged with the World Trade Organization. In addition to that, they also said that they would start national security-related supply chain talks between the two countries to try to improve controls on materials and components that are critical to national security or could be used in weapons.
And what about the Military Information Sharing Pact, GSOMIA? South Korea, at the time in 2019, threatened to pull out of the pact at the height of tensions. Although Seoul did not pull out the pact in the end, the information sharing has not been operating at full capacity since then. But I understand that they announced that they would now continue with that as well.
Right. That will restart again, as well as they will resume high-level military and diplomatic talks regularly between, I guess, both defense agencies as well as the diplomatic agencies. And they will also resume talks at the vice ministerial level as well as other talks. Also, there was one issue that, I guess, has not been resolved, and Kishida didn't really directly address it, just saying that, you know, there are issues that they would address bilaterally as they move forward to try to build upon a better relationship. And one of the issues that came up was the, I guess, in 2018, when South Korean military had locked radar on a Japanese self-defense force plane. Mm.
Issues related to the compensation for victims of Japan's wartime forced labor have been at the center of tension in recent years, of course. That's after South Korea's Supreme Court ordered Japanese corporations to pay reparations to Korean victims in 2018. But the Yoon administration recently announced that Seoul will not enforce that court decision and that the victims will instead be compensated through a local foundation. The plan also did not compel the Japanese defendant corporations to contribute to this fund, and this has caused political controversy at home. There was perhaps some speculation in recent days that Kishida would address the wartime forced labor issue somehow. How did Kishida address this issue at the meeting in the end and during the news conference afterwards?
Okay, well, in terms of the forced labor issue, I mean, he appreciated the moves that had been made by President Yoon in terms of addressing it domestically. But there was no discussion about Japan doing anything sort of reciprocally regarding that. One thing that was discussed was the bilateral fund between the Korean and Japanese businesses to set up a fund to improve both cultural and educational exchanges.
Sure. Moves by Yoon to improve relations have been had a mixed reaction back here in Korea. Meanwhile, how has Yoon's visit been perceived by the Japanese public at the moment?
I think the visit has been taken very well by the Japanese public. As was mentioned by both leaders, the interest in the populace in both countries and the other countries is very high. And I believe President Yoon talked about how Japanese and Koreans, they talk about their reciprocal countries being the places that they most want to visit. And so, you know, building upon that, I think Japan as a whole, because the relations have been sort of up and down. I mean, I've been looking at this for over 30 years. And, you know, depending on the changes in the administration, they sort of go up and down. And I think the Japanese side, you know, was looking for some way to try to overcome some of these issues. And it's not only Japan, it's also the United States, because they have these sort of regional security issues that they want to deal with, you know, from North Korea to China as well. And in order to do that, they need the United States' closest allies in the region, South Korea and Japan, to be on the same page.
Okay, and looking back then through your experience, how do you think South Korean-Japan relations will pan out going forward now? What risks still remain?
Okay, I mean, I think the issues that have been mentioned, for example, on dealing with some of the issues that we've had in the past, I think both countries, you know, want to make sure that the procedures are go forward step by step, for example, in terms of dealing with the forced labor issue. And I think some of the other issues that have come up, like the radar lock-on on the Japanese self-defense force plane and also the sex slave issue, I mean, that will probably have to be dealt with at some point. But I think they're trying to make sort of the initial first steps to try to get things on the right track. I think looking at it, you know, over the last 30 years or so, as I mentioned earlier, depending on the administration in Seoul, it can be sort of hot or cold. And it's been very cold, I guess, in the past 12 years. I think most people in Japan and maybe even people in South Korea believe, you know, that the relations were at sort of the bottom, or probably the worst that they've been since World War II, or at least since 1965 when relations were normalized. So that's the one issue I think that people are always sort of concerned about in Japan, whether, you know, if there's the next administration will be as sort of forward-looking in terms of relations.
Well, we'll leave it there. We've been speaking to Mr. James Sims in Tokyo. Thank you once again for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Just hours before President Nguyen boarded a plane for his visit to Japan, North Korea fired a long-range ballistic missile, presumed to be an intercontinental ballistic missile, towards the East Sea on Thursday. Can you tell us more?
Well, the Joint Chiefs of Staff said the missile took off from the Sunan area in Pyongyang at around 7:10 a.m. Towards the East Sea, adding that it was fired at a lofted angle and flew about 1,000 kilometers. The South Korean military assessed the missile as similar to the North's newest ICBM, the Hwasong-17. Further analysis is still underway. North Korea previously fired what it claimed was a Hwasong-15 ICBM on February 18th at a lofted angle. The latest missile provocation, the sixth ballistic missile launched this year, comes 2 days after the North fired two short-range ballistic missiles from the Changyeon area of South Hwanghae province. Thursday's missile firing also comes amid Seoul and Washington's Freedom Shield joint military exercise.
Following the launch, President Yoon warned that North Korea will pay for its reckless provocation.
Yoon issued that warning as he attended a National Security Council meeting before departing for his summit with Kishida. Receiving a report on the North missile launch from National Security Advisor Kim Sung-han, Yoon ordered the military to thoroughly conduct the ongoing Freedom Shield joint drills with the U.S. to maintain readiness against North Korea. Top security and defense officials, including Foreign Minister Park Jin and Defense Minister Lee Jong-sup, also took part in the emergency NSC session presided by Kim. The NSC strongly condemned the North's missile launches as violations of UN Security Council resolutions, as well as serious provocations that raise tensions on the Korean Peninsula and threaten regional peace and security.
And speaking of the joint maneuvers, the South Korean Army and Air Force conducted a series of large-scale field training exercises, or FTX, in connection with the ongoing South Korea-US combined Freedom Shield exercise. What did they involve?
Well, the Army said on Thursday that the FTX involved airborne operations to transport equipment and material deep into enemy territory or combat zones, as well as air assault drills in which ground troops transported by helicopters assault enemy forces. The drills, which kicked off on Tuesday, involved some 1,500 troops from the Army's 2nd Quick Response Division and the Air Force's 5th Air Mobility Wing, with around 30 aircraft, including Lockheed C-130 Hercules transport aircraft. Meanwhile, the Air Force carried out drills involving key units Tuesday and Wednesday aimed at strengthening operational sustainability during wartime, focusing on immediately scrambling a jet on standby as soon as another returns to base after a sortie.
Let's turn to some other headlines now as well. Cho Min, the daughter of former Justice Minister Cho Guk, appeared in court on Thursday for a hearing on her suit against Busan National University for revoking her medical school admission. Can you tell us more?
Well, appearing at the Busan District Court as a witness, the younger Cho told reporters that she will sincerely answer questions as some 30 supporters gathered in front of the court to show their support for her, with signs declaring that she was accepted to the school based on her skills. Thursday will mark the first time for Cho to reveal her stance on the decision made by PUS last April to cancel her admission to the university's medical school in 2015 over the inclusion of forged documents in the application. The decision came after Cho's mother, Cheng Yong-shim, was sentenced to 4 years in prison over academic fraud related to her daughter's university admission. Following the school's decision, the former justice minister's daughter sought a court injunction against the cancellation of the medical school admission and filed a suit.
That's all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
U.S. tech lender Silicon Valley Bank collapsed last Friday, becoming the second largest bank failure in U.S. history. SVB's failure came suddenly after a stunning 48 hours, during which depositors rushed to withdraw their money from the bank, resulting in a bank run. As the bank's downfall sent shockwaves through global markets, here in Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol instructed relevant agencies to closely monitor any possible impact it may have on the domestic financial market and real economy. To get some expert analysis on SVB's fallout and what might come next, for Weekly Economy Review, we are joined on the line by economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor Yang, hello, and thank you for being on the show today.
Happy to be here.
Yes, we have brought forward our Weekly Economy Review segment a day earlier this week as the Yoon Kishida summit just ended, and we wanted to go over the outcomes of that meeting for our in-depth tomorrow. So, Professor, thank you for connecting with us a day earlier than usual. So today we want to look back at what happened with SVB. Professor, can you tell us a little bit more about Silicon Valley Bank? What was special about it? And then can you walk us through the collapse?
Okay, well, SVB was, before the collapse, classified as the 16th largest bank in the United States with asset size of $209 billion. Now, that seems big, and 16th place does seem rather high, but note that United States has 4,200 banks, and only four banks have assets above $1 trillion. The largest U.S. bank in terms of assets is J.P. Morgan Chase at $3.2 trillion, and only four banks, as I said, have assets higher than $1 trillion. Mm. Fifth largest bank, the asset size is $600 billion. So what you have in the United States are very few large banks, and then a slew of mid-sized banks as well as small banks. Now, SVB was known as a niche bank. It specialized in tech startup accounts, and it received deposits from tech startups. It was known for having personal relationships with some of the tech leaders, tech startup CEOs. So they had a lot of accounts from startup tech companies, and these startup tech companies didn't sometimes did not have accounts on any other bank. They did not spread out their bank accounts. Mm. And that turned out to be one of the problems that caused this massive bank run. Now, when the SVB receives deposits from these tech startups, it invested that money in government bonds. By itself, that's not unusual. But when the Fed started raising the interest rates very quickly, starting last year, the value of these government bonds fell drastically. And apparently what happened is this reduction in prices of government bonds affected all the banks, but for SVB, it hit the bank more than most other banks because they apparently had some problems with their risk management. Right. Apparently, their risk management leader wasn't in place for most of the time during this period. So they needed cash very quickly, and they sold some of these bonds at a loss, which was a bad signal to give to depositors. But in order to raise cash, they decided to issue stocks. That, again, that's not an unusual event. That's in some ways something that's desirable. But while they explained the situation very clearly to investors, they did not explain this question, this problem to depositors. Mm. So when the depositors found that SVB was raising money, trying to raise money very quickly, they got it as a signal that SVB did not have enough cash on hand. And that problem was amplified by various Twitter accounts, because after all, these are tech firms, and various tech-related people, including Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal, spread Twitter messages saying, you better get your money out of SVB very quickly, otherwise they will not have any cash left to give to you. So the bank run in that sense was a traditional old-fashioned bank run that was amplified by SNS messages, and it took place incredibly quickly. Apparently, the bank went from relatively healthy to a level of collapse in only 36 hours.
Right.
And the rapid pace could be seen. During this type of bank runs and bank collapse, the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, goes in, takes over the bank, usually to minimize disruptions in the capital markets. They go in after business hours on Friday. They do all their jobs during the weekend, and by Monday morning when the bank opens, they should be running more or less normally so that depositors can get their money from Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. But this time, the FDIC took the bank over during Friday afternoon. They couldn't even wait a few hours until the market finished for the day. So that gives you an indication exactly how quickly this bank run took place.
Yes, it was an absolutely stunning 36 to 48 hours, as you said. Quite remarkable. It ended up meaning that Silicon Valley Bank became the largest US bank to fail since the 2008 financial crisis. The concern was then that it would lead to a broader banking meltdown like we saw in 2008. But Professor, it's been 6 days now. Are there any signs of such a domino effect? Is there any risk that more banks might fall?
Okay, well, the entire reason why that type of worry started out in the first place was that just before SVB collapsed, a bank called Silvergate, which specialized in cryptocurrency, decided to go out of business because they did not have assets enough to cover their deposits. Mm. And then a couple of days after SVB collapsed, Signature Bank also collapsed. And they were also dealing with cryptocurrency because the value of cryptocurrency fell so much during last year and this year. They did not have enough assets to cover their deposits. And in case of Signature Bank, they thought that they could get over the fall in the asset prices, but the Fed advised them to quit while they were still ahead. Obviously, the FDIC and the Fed were afraid that if the Signature Bank collapsed as well, or at least had a bank run, then that would have led to a contagion effect leading to bank runs other places. Now, bank runs are Well, they're economic events, but they're not really caused by economics. They're more caused by psychological effect. Mm. So when depositors see a lot of bank runs, then even if their bank is healthy, they may want to take their money out quickly, and that could lead to even a healthy bank collapsing.
Right.
And we've seen some signs of that happening in the United States. A lot of depositors were switching their money from medium-sized banks to large banks, the aforementioned banks with more than $1 billion deposits. Those banks are typically considered too big to fail. So we did see some switching of deposits. And because the Fed was worried about that, they have installed a new lending facility for any bank which has depositors coming in. And if they have less cash on hand to cover that, then they can go to the Fed and borrow the cash to pay back the depositors. And that seems to have calmed the market, at least in the United States. We have not seen further bank runs. We did see some reductions in prices of stocks in these medium-sized banks, but they seem to be recovering now.
Mm.
But where the problem may have jumped to is actually Europe. Credit Suisse, which was known as the weakest of the global systematically important banks, global investment banks, they were always thought to be in trouble. But now the stock prices of Credit Suisse is declining rapidly. That came about because there was an announcement that the major largest stockholder of Credit Suisse, which is the Saudi Arabian Central Bank, they were not going to put more money into Credit Suisse. But that was because of the Swiss banking laws. Even if they wanted to, the Saudi Central Bank could not put more money into Credit Suisse. But that problem may be solving itself because Credit Suisse has announced that they are getting loans from the Switzerland Central Bank of about $54 billion.
Right.
So right now, the European market is just starting to open, but the expectation is that the European market will calm down because mm-hmm. of the central bank loan.
Right. So although there were some signs of contagion effects, but it seems like it is being contained somewhat. So let's look ahead then. One of the causes of the situation with SVB was that the US Federal Reserve aggressively hiking interest rates over the past year in a bid to tamp down on inflation. The next rate hike decision is scheduled to be announced next week. Do you think the SVB situation will have any impact on the Fed's decision there? Has been some people who have said that the situation shows that it's time for the Fed to stop its rate hikes.
Well, of the three central banks, two are really due to cryptocurrency. Now, you can argue that the reason that cryptocurrency prices fell is because of interest rates rising, but that's really a very weak argument to make. The only bank that's really been affected by the rising interest rates and falling bond prices to this extent is the SVB. Other banks have been hit by this problem as well, but they seem to be weathering a lot better than SVB. And the last consumer price index figure, which came out a couple of days ago, does show that while the headline inflation for the month of February fell from 0.5 to 0.4, the core inflation rate actually rose from 0.4 in January to 0.5. So that means that the Fed will probably have to raise the interest rate, perhaps not at 50 basis points as what a lot of other people had argued before SVB, but probably they will have to raise it by 25 basis points.
Meanwhile, here in Korea, the financial sector has, of course, been nervous as well. But earlier this week, the finance minister, Choo Kyung-ho, said that it's too early to predict the repercussions of SVB's sudden bankruptcy, adding that the government will be on high alert and closely watch the situation. Professor, what impact could the U.S. bank's downfall have on South Korea's economy, including its domestic banking sector?
Well, so far, the only direct effect that we've seen is through the Korean National Pension Service. Korean National Pension Service had about 1.2 trillion won of SVB stocks and about 17.1 billion won worth of SVB bonds. That's about $93 million and $13 million. So National Pension Service will take a hit. And then more indirectly, the several Korean startups did have accounts on SVB. They will be fully compensated, but because of the global crisis, the bank stock prices everywhere, including Korea, has been falling. But somewhat paradoxically, expectations of U.S. interest rate falling, which I don't think will take place, but still increasing expectation that U.S. will lower interest rates in the near future because of the banking problems, they're lowering the Korean market rates. I don't think this will continue, but that has been one of the effects. And then Korean won has been very shaky because when we have a nervous financial markets like this, Korean and international investors, well, they fly, they have this flight to safety. They go to the safest investment available, which is usually in the U.S. dollar government bond type of investment. So what we've seen in the exchange rates are a lot of instability where the won exchange rate is changing by even more than 10 won per day.
Well, finally then, Professor, what lessons can South Korea learn from SVB's demise? In fact, not just South Korea, I guess, but everywhere, really.
Okay, well, the one problem is whenever you have problems like this, you have flight to safety for international investors. That means moving into the United States investments. For regular people, Koreans, that means moving their money from what they perceive as weaker banks to stronger banks. In Korea, that means moving money from savings banks to the big four or big five banks. That seems to be, we seem to be seeing some of that right now. Korea also has deposit insurance, but it's only up to 50 million won. That's about $38,000 compared to $250,000 in the United States. If we want people to leave their money in some of these weaker banks, perhaps we have to raise deposit insurance. Mm. But the problem with that is that if you raise deposit insurance, that gives incentive for these weaker banks to engage in highly profitable but also highly risky investments, which may in the long run do more harm than good. So we may need to raise high the deposit insurance, but we also may need to strengthen regulatory supervision on financial institutions and also raise deposit insurance premiums if we are going to give more we're going to have a higher limit on deposits which have insurance. But savings banks right now are against that because, well, Korea had a savings bank crisis a few years ago. Mm. And because of that, savings banks are already paying a higher premium than regular banks. So there might be a resistance by savings banks to raising the deposit insurance.
Well, the financial world has really been shaken up over the last 2 weeks. Everyone is waiting, I think, nervously to see if any other dominoes do fall. It looks like it has stabilized somewhat for now, but we'll have to watch this situation closely. Professor Yang, we'll leave it there. Thank you, as always, for your analysis, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update.
The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 1.81 points, or 0.08% on Thursday, to close the day at 2,377.91. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ rose, however, gaining 0.81 points, or 0.10%, to close at 781.98. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 9.31 against the U.S. dollar, closing the day at 1,313 won.
You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we take a look at some of the other news headlines that have been trending online. And for that, we have our contributor, Diane Yu, joining us in the studio. Diane, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jang. It's good to see you too.
Okay, so what do you have for us today?
First, we'll talk about a tragic story of how a senior care facility's negligence led to a man's death. Next, we'll take a look at concerns being raised over a recently opened maid cafe in Seoul. And finally, we'll discuss South Korean defender Kim Min-jae and Napoli making club history in one of Europe's biggest football tournaments.
Okay, let's get into that first story then. Can you tell us more?
It can be difficult for people to look after their parents when they are older, especially if that parent suffers from a serious disease like dementia. That's why some of them place their parents in senior care centers to get professional help. To find out that your dad or mom died after getting beaten at the care center, that's the last thing you'd expect. But that's exactly what happened to a man in his 80s with dementia last month, who died 23 days after entering a nursing home in Paju City, Gyeonggi Province.
Well, that sounds truly devastating. What happened exactly?
On February 18th, the nursing home rushed the man to a nearby hospital as he was vomiting and feeling sick. On that day, the doctor said that he suffered a cerebral hemorrhage due to external shock. When the bereaved family asked if something happened at the center, the nursing home informed them that he had been assaulted, saying, "There was an argument with another patient in the evening. Unfortunately, the next day, the man passed away." When the police checked the CCTV footage of the nursing home, they made a shocking discovery. They found that the man was assaulted 6 times by 2 patients from February 11th to the 18th.
Right, so it was other patients that assaulted him, not any of the staff or anything like that.
Right.
I'm assuming that the other patients were suffering from dementia as well or some sort of illness, considering the viciousness of the attacks, it seems.
Right.
But it must be infuriating for the family that the care centre was not properly watching over the patients and that they had to find out about the assaults from CCTV footage, not even the center itself.
Right. It seems that the nursing home did not even try to properly look into what had been going on. Looking at the nursing diaries written at the facilities from late January to mid-February, there was no record of assault at all. There were only 4 memos with scuffles, quarrels, and physical fight written. But it was worse than what had been noted down. The bereaved family has said that the footage from the 14th of last month even showed the deceased helplessly being assaulted by another patient while being tied to his wheelchair. So with the 6 of the assaults revealed by CCTV footage and 1 incident that was acknowledged by the nursing home, the man was assaulted a total of 7 times since the first day he entered the facility.
Has the family taken any legal action against the nursing home?
Yes. Last week, the family sued the nursing home for not properly protecting the 80-year-old. The Paju Police Station also booked and investigated the director and secretary of the facilities on charge of involuntary manslaughter. The police have requested an autopsy from the National Forensic Service to determine the exact cause of death. We'll have to wait and see how the investigation will pan out.
Well, the footage certainly looks damning, and yes, it is indeed a nightmare scenario for those who send their loved ones to such a facility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
A Japanese-style maid cafe where waitresses are dressed as maids and serve drinks opened just yesterday in Seoul's Mapo District. This cafe operates on a reservation basis, and it's so popular that all reservations for March were booked on the first day of opening. But concerns have been raised about the business.
Yes, this is a popular attraction in Japan, but it has raised concerns as well. There's a lot of controversy about these sorts of cafes.
Right.
But for our listeners who may not know, can you describe to us what exactly a maid cafe is?
So at these cafes, staff dressed in maid uniforms call customers master and serve food and drinks. Their job is to act like a maid, which is described as a female domestic servant in the dictionary. At this recently opened cafe, a total of 28 waitresses were recruited as of last Saturday, with 3 to 4 of them working per day. This is not the first time that this type of establishment has been open in Korea. There have been several in the past, but most of them are known to have closed.
Right, and can you walk us through the concerns that have been raised?
People's views on this type of cafe differ. While there are those who say that it should be understood as part of Japanese culture, others say that it is excessive commercialization of sex. Residents in the neighborhood have also said that the cafe is within a 5-minute walk from an elementary school, so they are concerned with clothes that are offensive to children. However, May cafes are neither illegal nor labeled as adult entertainment venues. The establishment has been firm to protect their staff, saying that it will take legal action against any sexual harassment. It also announced that filming without the consent of the staff is illegal.
Right, so we should stress that these cafes do not offer sexual services, but
right.
The criticism has always been that they objectify women and that it's suggestive of adult themes as well.
Yes.
So it's no surprise that this has caused a stir, especially as it is so close to an elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to see if the local residents or any other people do continue to raise objections to this cafe.
Yes.
Let's move on to the final story of the day, and it's from the World of Football about South Korea's Kim Min-jae and Italy's Napoli.
Okay. History was written in Italy on Thursday. South Korean centre-back Kim Min-jae and Italy's Serie A leader Napoli have made it to the quarterfinals of the UEFA Champions League for the first time ever. The centre-back, who suffered a calf muscle injury in a league game last weekend, started the second leg of the UCL round of 16 against Eintracht Frankfurt. It was held at the Diego Armando Maradona Stadium in Naples, Italy. Kim even received the highest rating among Napoli defenders with 7.6 points based on whoscored.com, a football statistics website.
Yes, Napoli and Kim are having an amazing season so far, sitting mm-hmm. top of Serie A, an incredible 18 points ahead of second place. And now they've reached the top eight of the prestigious Champions League competition as well.
Right.
So, can you tell us about how the match went against Frankfurt?
Yes. So, Napoli beat German side 3-0 with two goals from striker Victor Osimhen in the 47th and 53rd minute of the game. Midfielder Peter Zielinski grabbed the third from the penalty spot in the 64th minute. Kim was solid at the back, blocking the opponent's penetrating pass in the box in the 44th minute. He also dominated the air, winning four aerial challenges, the most among players from both teams. After a good performance, the South Korean was taken off in the 66th minute, with substitute Juan Jesus coming on as his replacement.
Right, so overall it was a dominating performance from Kim and the Italian side then.
That's right. Napoli made it through the next round, winning 5-0 on aggregate as they won the first leg 2-0. Now all eyes on who Kim and the Italian side will face next. That will be decided on Friday in Nyon, Switzerland. The other teams left in the tournament include Chelsea, Bayern Munich, Inter Milan and Real Madrid.
That's all for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Diane, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
It's time now for our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we journey across the peninsula, discovering more about some of the cultural, historical, and travel highlights that the nation has to offer. And joining us this week, it is the welcome return of our history and travel explorer, Alison Needles, from the website Pinpoint Korea. Ali, hello. Long time no talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on the show with us. We know you've been busy, so we appreciate you coming back. Okay, so this week we are starting to feel the start of spring. The cold weather is easing up and the days are getting longer. But it can also be a stressful time. For example, it's tax season, the new semesters are starting, and there's also the grim air pollution around this time of year. So perhaps this is also the period that we need to find time more than ever to relax. And that is mm-hmm. our main topic today, right? Because we are talking about Seoul Relax Week, Ali.
Yeah, that's right. I'm excited to talk about that. I've never heard of it before. So I think it will be really interesting for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's called Seoul Relax Week, but I actually understand that it is a series of events that takes place throughout March and early April as well, focusing on well-being and meditation based on Buddhism. So with that in mind, before we get into Relax Week, Ali, can you tell us a little bit about the history of Buddhism in Korea?
Yeah, absolutely. So the history of Buddhism in Korea goes back a long time. It was actually adopted as the state religion during the Three Kingdoms period, So that's as early as the 4th century CE. And the Three Kingdoms period was the Shilla, Baekje, and the Goguryeo kingdoms. And there were two famous texts from that time period, the Samguk Yusa and the Samguk Sagi. And they have records that three monks brought the Dharma or the Buddhist teachings to Korea at this time. So there was an Indian Buddhist monk named Malananta, and he brought Buddhism to Baekje. Mm. There was the Sundo monk from China who brought Buddhism to Goguryeo. And then there was Ado, the Buddhist monk, who is said to have brought Buddhism to Shilla. And of course, like, you know, most foreign religions, it wasn't actually accepted right away in any of these kingdoms.
Right.
At this point, Koreans had most likely practiced kind of tribal gods, ancestor worship, things more similar to what we know as like shamanism. But Buddhism was very much promoted in the royal house because it, you know, it stabilized ruling ideology and also gave the rulers kind of a heightened sense of power. You know, for example, the Buddha was this supreme being that seems like a good match for royal lineages.
Mm.
And what was interesting in particular about Buddhism in Korea is that it did actually end up incorporating a lot of the local religion into its practices and its systems. So, for example, other religious deities and protectors became protectors and devotees of the Buddha. And that kind of blend of shamanism and Buddhism is still seen in Korea today at both respective temples, so at a shaman temple or a Buddhist temple.
Right.
And with the fall of the Baekje and the Goguryeo kingdoms between 663 and 668 under the Shilla dynasty's power, the Shilla dynasty really, really is the time where Buddhism spread quickly all over Korea. And Shilla itself today is known as a very Buddhist kingdom. And that continued into the next kingdom, Goryeo. And if you look at Goryeo art, so much of the best art from that time period is Buddhist paintings and Buddhist statues. However, the last dynasty of Korea, the Joseon dynasty, their state ideology was Confucianism, but Buddhism was still allowed to be practiced, albeit a little bit quietly. But interestingly, the earliest texts to ever be translated into the Korean language during the Joseon dynasty were Buddhist texts. So, of course, it was kind of a more of a cultural significance rather than a religious one at that time.
Right, so you've given us a quick but thorough summary of the history of Buddhism in Korea.
Maybe not too quick.
But some people may be wondering what school of Buddhism Korea follows. Can you enlighten us on that too?
Yeah, so Buddhism lineages in Korea are mainly under what is called the Sun lineage, which is a type of Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism encourages its followers to enlighten themselves in order to then enlighten and help other beings. And the Sun lineage is represented by the Jogye and Taego orders, which I think a lot of people will be familiar with or recognize from the name Jogye Temple near Insadong in northern Seoul, Jogye-sa. And it's very similar to Chan Buddhism of China or Zen Buddhism of Japan, for those who might be more familiar with those.
Okay, so thank you for telling us all about that. But going back to our main topic today then, what does all this have to do with this whole Relax Week?
Well, the Seoul Relax Week actually only started in 2019, and I guess maybe at that point it was only 1 week, but as you mentioned, it's extended now. And it's basically an educational festival and program that brings together international and national experts in the field of meditation and Buddhism. And it's built of all these conferences around meditation with very famous speakers offering lectures. Mm. They also have meditation classes for new, like first timers or people who are already very familiar with it. And what's interesting is that they offer these classes in very peaceful spots around Seoul. And they recommend those as places to improve your mental and physical health. So not only places that are good for meditating, but also exercising. They also have a list on their website of great vegan and vegetarian and temple food restaurants. And I really recommend people go and check out their website because they've got a full map of all of Seoul and all these various locations that will help you in whatever personal relaxation needs you're looking for.
Right, so it seems meditation is the key word.
Right.
So we can say that Seoul Relax Week is not just about relaxing, but also about finding a peace of mind as well through Buddhist practices and teachings on meditation. Can you tell us more about the special guests that will be taking part throughout the event period?
Yeah, in this particular year, they've got experts across a number of fields. So they have Buddhist monks, they have musicians, and even neuroscientists. Three people that really stood out to me when I was looking at the list was a monk named Jinu, who is an expert in Sun Buddhism of Korea. And he very strongly promotes kind of clear, uncomplicated spiritual messages and guidance. Mm. There's also a monk called Moon Gwang, and he's actually a professor who holds a PhD in philosophy. And interestingly, there's a band called Kierensia, I think is how you pronounce it, and they promote the development of meditation-based music, so music that helps you meditate. So they're going to be performing as well this year.
Well, that sounds interesting. Kierensia, I believe, is the pronunciation of that band. It certainly sounds interesting. Apart from lectures and meditation, what else can guests do during a Seoul Relax Week?
There's a wide variety of events going on, all of them based in well-being. There's Tibetan singing bowl classes, lots of Buddhist arts and crafts for children at different temples around Seoul, lots of different live music performances, and Q&A sessions with monks from many different temples and many different orders.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a lot going on. Where and when are these events taking place?
The main events happen every Saturday in March until the 25th, so until next weekend. So this is the last day with the main events, and every week has a different main event. It is, however, limited to 100 people, and you should go on the website and register in advance and make sure that you get there early and on time.
Mm.
We'll also have things called Dharma Talk conversations with monks and other lecturers and specialists in Dharma, and that's happening on March 30th. At the Center for the Jogye Order. So that's at Jogyesa Temple. That starts at 10 a.m. Registration is free, but again, seats fill up very quickly. So make sure that you go check out the website and get all of the schedule planned.
Mm.
But don't be too sad if you miss something, because they have a lot of other events and lectures happening with foreign and domestic monks starting from March 31st until April 2nd. So that will be going on during the weekday, during the weekends, and all different kinds of temples. So you can just check the official website for whatever interests you. And then again, you can go check out their meditation spots, and you can go and visit anytime.
Yes, so for more information, check out the website, which is relaxweek.kr. Although we do have to warn our international listeners that the website is only available in Korean.
Yes.
Finally, Ali, any events that you're most excited about personally?
I really strongly recommend going to watch a Q&A session with a monk and speaking with them if you can. I always find that I'm very grounded when I speak with them. They're very good at reminding listeners of being in the present and what's really important in life. So I'm really looking forward to attending some of these lectures and Q&A sessions with the Buddhist monks.
Indeed, they do sound great. Okay, well, I hope you enjoy Relax Week. Thank you for telling us all about it, Ali, and we look forward to talking to you again soon. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Did you enjoy this segment? You can discover more segments like this throughout the week on Korea 24. On Monday, we bring you news from the world of sports around the peninsula. Then on Tuesday, notable guests from various fields join us and give us insight into their lives and work. Are you a fan of books? Then tune in on Wednesday for Korea Book Club, where our book critic helps us unpack works by Korean authors or written on Korea. Go on an adventure with us every Thursday as we take a look at Korea's hidden gems with Explorer Korea. And on Friday, listen to what our film critics have to say about the latest movie releases from both home and abroad. We have all that you need, all in one place, on Korea 24.
It's time now for our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And to bring us those stories, we have joining us in the studio our staff editor, Richard Larkin. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello. Good to see you too.
Okay, so what's the first story that you have for us today?
First is an interesting story I found in the People section of the Korea Times. Jun Ji-hae's article is about a promising boxer from Ukraine called Anatoly Yem, who dreams of representing Korea. It really is a fascinating read.
Okay, so he's from Ukraine,
yes,
but wants to represent South Korea. Mm-hmm. Is he currently living in the country now then?
He is. Yem moved to Korea in March last year, a month after the start of the Russia-Ukraine war.
Mm.
His parents were already living here for work. His father is Korean-Ukrainian and his mother is Ukrainian, and they both settled in Gimhae City. Before coming to Korea to start his new life, Yem was an experienced junior boxer in Ukraine. The article mentions that he won medals at several international events. He was able to carry on his training in Gimhae, but there was one big problem. As a Ukrainian national, He cannot join a team nor participate in tournaments in Korea.
Right, so if you can't participate, you can't improve your level as well. So that really is an unfortunate obstacle. Is there something that can be done then so that he can keep going as a boxer?
There is. One way is for Yam to become a naturalized Korean. And it looks like he has been receiving a lot of support to do this. Kim Hae-sit has even issued a letter of recommendation last month to help with the process. Two boxing associations and a global youth center based in the city and Yam School have also joined to help with this application. In South Korea, it is possible for the government to grant citizenship to those who hold special talents and can contribute to the nation's development. So it looks possible.
Yes, we have spoken to several athletes on this show that have gone through that process to represent Korea at the Olympics. There's definitely an avenue there. We'll just have to see if he is able to go through that process as well. In the meantime, we can find out more in tomorrow's Korea Times. Let's move on to our second story, Audia, for us.
Next, we have Park Yuna's article in the Weekender section of the Korea Herald. It's about the first museum dedicated to contemporary artist Park So-bo that will be built on Jeju Island.
Yes, so Park is seen as a contemporary art master in Korea. But for our listeners who may not know who he is, can you give us a brief background?
Sure. The artist was born in 1931 and is mostly known as the founder of the Dansaekhwa movement. The article mentions that this is an abstract art movement unique to Korea. Also called monochrome painting, the movement began in the late 1960s and 70s, and he has had a decades-long career. The 91-year-old artist is still painting to this day, despite recently finding out that he has stage 3 lung cancer. Park has decided not to have treatment for the disease because it meant he couldn't paint if he did. So instead, he has been pushing for a museum to be built so that his work can help other people.
Wow, so even despite his illness, he's still going strong.
Yes.
You mentioned that the museum will be built on Jeju Island. Do we know when it will be open?
Well, we don't have too many details about the building, but we know that it will open in the summer of 2024. The Park So-bo Museum will be operated by the Gizi Foundation, which was established by the artist in 2019 to manage his work.
Yes, it'll be amazing if he's still around to open the museum as well.
Right.
Possibly a Park So-bo Museum opening in Jeju Island in the summer of 2024. Okay, we'll wrap it up there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Richard, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
And that's all for our show today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.
KBS World Radio offers all you need to know on Korea through its various programs. Tune in to One Fine Day with Lena Park and join the K-pop diva for 2 fine hours every weekday. Are you into the latest K-pop tracks? Then K-pop Connection is your fix. Brian Ju brings you the best of K-pop and K-culture. On Korea 24, host Kwon Jang-ho helps listeners digest all the biggest stories coming out of South Korea. Keep up with what's happening on the peninsula by listening to Korea 24. Learn about Korean folktales on Mondays with global audiobook Once Upon a Time in Korea. If you're a bookworm, don't miss Books on Demand, a program that introduces Korean literature to the global audience every Tuesday. Our Wednesday program, Korea Today and Tomorrow, provides news on the latest diplomatic developments in and around the Korean Peninsula. Want to go deeper than K-pop? Sounds of Korea takes a closer look at various traditional music every Thursday. KBS World Radio is your go-to channel for all things Korea. Tune in!
KBS World Radio strives to promptly update our listeners on safety procedures during emergency situations. The following are recommended guidelines to follow in case of forest fires. Before hiking, ensure the mountain trail is safe and does not have restricted entry. Make sure you aren't carrying flammable items such as matches and cigarettes. Only cook or light a campfire in permitted areas. If a fire must be lit in an area adjacent to a forest zone, obtain permission from relevant authorities beforehand and take special cautions so that the fire does not spread. To prevent small fires from spreading, use your coat or jacket to put it out. If you need to evacuate, move to roads or rocky spots without traces of fuel. If you do not have enough time to evacuate, move to a spot with less fuel, leaves or branches. Scrape away the flammable material, cover your face and wait until the flames pass. If you witness or have any information on forest fires, contact police or forest authorities immediately. You can dial 119 for emergency services. Please check our website at wild.kbs.co.kr for up-to-date information and procedures.
Yeah.